Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I think this is the first Dhamma reflection since the retreat started, other than the introduction to the retreat and the Dhamma readings we've been doing. It was remembering back when I first started sitting meditation retreats at lay retreat centers. Joseph Goldstein was leading one of the retreats that I was doing, and it was at the Insight Meditation Society. And I think it was after the second or third day, he kind of, during his evening Dhamma talk, he's like, "So you're probably wondering what these insights are, you know, these insights that you're supposed to be getting." He said, "I can guarantee you, you've probably experienced the first one. You already know the first one, which is, this practice is painful." So it's a, you know, as he was saying it, you know, half as a joke, but it, you know, and honestly, that is one of the very first, you know, the insight that the Buddha had as well. And so like the second insight is that things are changing. So it's dukkha and then anicca, the first two insights. And I was reflecting on this, and when I was at Amravati, they have a kind of a common area for the monks and novices and anagarikas to have tea at, and there's the table where the monks usually sat around. One day somebody put down this brochure from some kind of fringe religious organization, and it was Christian, but it was kind of, we couldn't figure out what the organization was, but had this very professional brochure out, and it kind of sat there for two or three days, and then I noticed it would be put into the recycling bin, and then some next day it would show up back on the table again, and that happened like two or three times, and I was thinking, well, maybe I should read this. This thing's got it's got its own power. It keeps reemerging. So I just one day having tea, just started reading through it, and the pamphlet was titled Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it made this incredible claim that starts off with many people, you know, ask this question, you know, why does God allow suffering? And they said, they made this claim that just by asking that question proved that God exists, which I thought it was great because my mind went completely blanked when they made that statement. I thought, well, that's a great meditation, you know, just, you know, make a statement like that and just the mind goes completely silent. So I thought, that's a great meditation, makes my mind go silent. But you know, thinking about it, it's like, I think it's interesting that the Buddha didn't approach the teachings with that question. You know, it's a, you know, the way, you know, he approached it was that it was in Wings to Awakening. Ajahn Jeff has the phrase, or he shows where the Buddha makes the statement that, you know, he's contemplating still as an unenlightened being. As, you know, so he sees that he's subject to birth, aging, and death, to sickness, sorrow, lamentation, dukkha. You know, he sees that he's in this predicament. And I also think it's interesting that, you know, at that time, right before he did go into homelessness, you know, his wife was pregnant. And so he was, you know, also thinking, you know, not just about himself, but also was his family, you know, that he was, yeah, bringing in a child into the world, and that this child is also subject to that, and all of his family. And he was also, you know, from a ruling family, so it's like not only himself, but his community. You know, so he was, you know, responsible in realizing that, I am subject to all of these things. But then his question was, it's like, well, why is it if, I'm subject to these things, why is it that I'm seeking after things that are also subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, things that are changing, things that are falling apart, things that are unstable? He could see that everything in his existence, his own body, his position of authority, his maybe his friendships, physical possessions, everything around him he could see were changing and unstable and not trustworthy. And so that was the Buddha's impetus. It wasn't like, why does suffering exist? Or, why did somebody else create it? Not even taking responsibility, but, blaming somebody else for it. And he was looking at, why am I seeking after? Why am I seeking? Or if I am seeking, why not seek? Then he actually asked the question, why don't I seek that which is unborn, uncreated, that isn't subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death? Maybe there is an escape. And so, that's the foundation of the Buddhist path. And I think it's really important to contemplate that, especially at the beginning of retreat, that we can see this practice is not always comfortable. I was thinking, for many of us, it's not that many more hours of sitting a day. There is usually the morning period where we're out being physical and working and maybe more in our bodies. But, the morning pujas, the meetings that we have, the afternoon period, we usually have the afternoons open for meditation. We have the tea time, evening puja, time after evening puja till morning puja. Very little has actually changed in our schedule other than that morning work period. One big thing that's different is that a lot of our responsibilities and duties have been set aside if we're living here as a monastic. And so that gives us more time and freedom. You can set down a lot of that perceived responsibility, and you can focus more on the practice. I just wanted to add in here just a bit of gratitude for the retreat crew that's come to actually allow that to happen, giving up 6 weeks or 3 months or longer of your schedules, your life to come and support the monastic community in doing that. And so all of us feel a lot of gratitude to you, and wish you the best for your retreat as well. And so, coming back to the, starting the retreat, it's good to realize that, when we do have the unpleasant sensations, or maybe the physical or mental, that it's not a problem. It actually is to be expected. I think if we can think of that as a problem, or I'm just doing something wrong, or why did God create this? Then we can kind of be going in the wrong direction. But just having that knowledge, this is normal, this is to be expected. It can give some freedom around that, can give some space, and also then the second insight is things change. So it's like it might be painful at the beginning, might be painful, in the middle, but eventually if we learn, we pay attention, make adjustments, as our understanding increases and changes, then that tension, that stress, the pain can dissipate. It's interesting just in looking at how things can change and understanding increases. It's like with the physical therapy that I've been doing, seeing the same doctor 17 years later, and he's having me do the exact same stretches that I did back then, And it was only this time was like only like a week into doing the stretches. And you know, I can see also too that I spent a little bit of time, maybe about a month, helping Ajahn Pasana with his stretching. So I was maybe able to see it from a different perspective, doing the physical therapy with him and seeing how it was affecting his body and the you know having an image in your head of your own body, like what your own posture looks like, you know, may or may not be actually accurate. But then to see Ajahn Pasana kind of in the same postures and actually supporting him and maybe even pushing him further into a posture. And then as I was doing those same postures myself, I got a sense of, oh, it's actually, yeah, this area is maybe should be focused on more. But at just some point, just a couple of days ago, I was in a stretch, and it's hard to say why, but there's like a deeper understanding came of what that stretch was supposed to be doing. And say it was, yeah, something I'd been, had, you know, learned 17 years ago. And I was like, oh, well, if that's actually the case of, you know, this is where the stretch is going, then if I just move my hips just an inch over this direction, and as soon as I did that, like my back, there's three discs that are out of alignment, and all of a sudden it just went crack, crack, crack. All three of the discs sort of came right into, felt like alignment. I couldn't tell. I can't see back there. But the energy, just all of a sudden, it was just like, the chi was just like completely flowing through my body, probably for the first time in 18 years. And I looked at that experience, though, it was like, you know, it's like, yeah, this was something, the exact same exercise, exact same experience that I had 17 years ago and didn't quite understand what was happening. But then, you know, all these years later and just different experiences and different discernment being used, different awareness of the body. I look at, you know, 17 years of having meditated and being aware of the body, then, you know, just to do it in 1 week. But I think it was over a year that I was seeing Dr. Bracewell the first time, you know, just in that little bit of time, just, you know, putting forth effort into the practice, you know, the wisdom, understanding can come, so there can be changes. I've been reflecting on the this, you know, kind of how to use this retreat in a skillful way, you know, in a way. Ajahn Kirunadamo, the first night, was talking about, you know, just, you know, paying attention to or appreciating the structure. I was having some conversations with some people in England and in here as well about, you know, sometimes structures can feel really restrictive. And so there's, you know, we were talking about this distinction between the word structure and being strict. And I made the point at one point, it's like some people, maybe myself even, at times can get the two, you know, actually thinking that they're the same thing. And in some ways, you can see that the, you know, like the way we live, the structures that we have, I think from a worldly perspective, they can seem extremely, you know, restrictive. And right before the retreat, I was actually looking online to trying to find, see if there were any writings of some of the monks who are around 20 vasas, maybe, who are now abbots of particular monasteries, but maybe haven't had any of their writings published. I was just trying to see if there was anything online if I could find any writings of monks like this, and accidentally, you know, I saw someone's name and saw something that somebody had written a really nice comment about this person. So I thought, oh, it's interesting. So I went to that site, and turns out it was a kind of one of these forums, Buddhist forums, where people ask questions and lots of people give their opinions. And occasionally I'll go to one of those if I'm going to give a Dhamma talk or if I'm interested in a particular topic, sometimes just to know what people think. But typically I don't like going to those sites because it's usually just a bunch of people's views and opinions. I think the only times I've ever done that before was when I was helping out with the bike pilgrimage, you know, a couple of years ago, and they did the theme of it was the Itipadas, and it was titled The Roads to Success, and received very few teachings on that. So I went online just to see what was actually available, and And I saw this one website, and the Itipadas is oftentimes you translate it as, you know, roads to success or basis for success, but it's also about psychic powers. So this whole website was, you know, someone asked the question, like, you know, do these psychic powers actually happen? And like 90% of the people, at least I only read like one page, but like almost every single person on there were like, you know, no, they don't exist. This is, you know, BS. It, you know, it's just something made up and it doesn't exist. And the one person sort of made the comment, says, well, actually, you know, it actually, you know, it's in the suttas and listed all the various suttas that were there. So there was like one person that was at least sort of, you know, presenting, you know, a side for, you know, that was I wouldn't say more rational, but at least you know, going by, you know, what is in scriptures versus they say just their opinions and views. But I was you know, reading up about this one monk and saw that you know, there were some, you know, criticisms of the way he was running his monastery, and you know, I was reading the a couple of the criticisms. I was just like, well, that's just, you know, like, just that's just the structure of our monastery, you know, just sort of, you know, getting up this early, or, you know, how much contact we have with the outside world and things like that. And I could see that, yeah, from a worldly perspective, that, you know, this would seem very strict or very, you know, authoritarian, or could cause difficulty. But how do you, you know, live in that, the, you know, what's the purpose of the structure? And Ajahn Kirtidhamma was pointing out that it really should be for, you know, creating space, creating freedom, you know, allowing us to not have to pick up, you know, certain aspects of life that it might be actually tempting. You know, it might be fun, could be interesting, could be engaging of the mind, but maybe they're not so profitable, especially for if you're trying to cultivate a mind that's more sensitive, that's more aware of, you know, physical sensations, or being aware of what's actually very subtly happening in the mind. You know, so the, you know, the structures are much more geared towards that, towards you know, simplification, you know, making life simpler. So I've been looking at the, you know, just the, even the, you know, say right now we do have you know, say full schedule for the practice. And the other day I was kind of thinking about this in terms of, you know, like for myself, like breaking down, you know, the day into sort of smaller, kind of manageable periods of, like, you know, so we have the, you know, on the schedule there on the door, what the times are for sitting, walking, you know, when the meals are, things like that. And in my own mind, I kind of broke it down into, like, say, 18 different sort of activities that we kind of do throughout the day. And so it's like, you know, a meditation period can be from, say, the moment that you first wake up in the morning, if it's by the alarm clock or just whenever you wake up naturally, from the period you wake up until we come down for morning puja. You know, that can be an entire, just one meditation period. And then the morning puja, that's the second one. And then the half-hour work period, we have our little chore, you know, how to use that as a meditation. And then, of course, there's the reading, and then the two sits after the reading, and then the meal, then the meal cleanup, and the period, you know, after that, that's free time. You know, how to use that free time as a meditation. It's not, oh, great, okay, now we can set the practice aside, I can relax, you know, sort of. Well, yeah, you can relax. But you know, how do you use that as a way of cultivating the mind, cultivating awareness? And then there's the sort of five periods in the afternoon where you can alternate sitting and walking, and then evening tea, evening puja, and then the period between end of evening puja till you wake up in the morning. So these are all, you know, like very distinct periods that you can, you know, think of as, you know, cultivate each one of those as a period for meditation. I personally like that in the sense that it gives that structure, gives that sort of safety. It's not like, oh, I got to be mindful all day long. You know, it's like, no, I can, I can practice in this period. And then in each one of those, you know, periods kind of has a different feel to it too. So it's like, you know, the qualities that you need to develop, say, you know, during that first period in the morning when you wake up, it's a very different type of meditation than when you're, you know, when you're one of the sitting periods in the afternoon, or the meal cleanup, or the work period where you're much more active in your body, maybe more interacting with other people. Like I notice, like the person who cleans up the monk's kind of bowl area, you know, it's like, you know, they're trying to clean the area, but you know, other people are coming in and trying to set up for the breakfast, or also needing maybe the same cleaning supplies that they're using. And so even though we're in silence, there's still give and take and, you know, interactions with each other. And so, you know, how to be mindful, how to be aware of our bodily movements and actions and interactions with each other. And just like, you know, just taking, you know, one, you know, so I was thinking, you know, like the morning when we wake up, that very first period of meditation there, it's like, you know, if you wake up by the alarm, or if you've made a determination just to get up whenever you wake up, you know, there's some, for myself, it's usually wake up like 1 minute before my alarm's supposed to go off, which is, I always found that interesting. And there can be a real tendency to, you know, reset the alarm, or to, I'm not a morning person, so there's like this, usually there's a major aversion when I wake up, kind of like, oh no, not again. And I was hoping there'd still be another 3 hours. And when I first was living here as an anagarika, I lived in the cloth yurt in the winter, and it's just impossible to heat that in the wintertime. So it'd be, you know, 30 degrees outside. It was 31 degrees inside the yurt. And so I had this down sleeping bag, and I was having a real hard time making it to morning pujas because it was just so comfortable inside the sleeping bag. So what I did is I set an alarm clock above my door. So I actually had to get up to get to the alarm clock. But I think on the second day I realized I could actually sit up still inside this cocoon. It just had just a little, you know, just so I could see through the eye holes was the only thing that was, you know, the whole sleeping bag was down to just enough for an air hole was all I had. But I could sit up. I actually found out how I could stand up, how I could hop over to the door. I could get my hand out of the little air hole, turn the alarm off, go back down and miss morning puja. So it developed some real skills that as an anagarika. But now that I'm in a cabin that has heat and it's much more comfortable, that still, that feeling is there though. I mean, we all know it. When you wake up, it's like so comfortable being under the covers, and there's always this feeling, there's always this thought that it's just going to be horrible when you get up. It says, you know, the body's going to be stiff, or the mind's going to be in pain. And so what I've discovered though is don't believe that thought. Really don't believe it, because 99.99% of the time is when I do get up, that feeling immediately vanishes. And it's actually more pleasant to be out from underneath the covers and walking around, you know, getting ready for the morning puja. Or, and so, you know, first piece of advice is, you know, whatever that, you know, aditana you have in the morning to get up, if it's with the alarm, or, but just, you know, just do it. And, you know, even having that recognition, that knowledge that, you know, again, that's the first noble truth. There's dukkha, you know, there is unpleasantness, but just face it. Just, you know, get up. And probably what's going to happen is that, you know, 10 seconds later, you're going to completely forget about that feeling that you had when you were, you know, laying underneath the covers. And it might be a little cooler in the room, or a little more, you know, just, it's going to be different changes, but we adjust very, very easily. Then, you know, it depends on what time you do get up, but, you know, you can start off the morning with, you know, the very first thing is once you've gotten up is to pay respects to our shrine. You know, just as soon as, you know, very, you know, your very first conscious thought can be after you've made that determination to get up is to, you know, bow to your shrine. you know, maybe just, you know, take a real quick second to, or a minute to, you know, just review your precepts, you know, especially if you're like on 5 precepts or 8 precepts or 10 precepts, very easy just to, you know, very first thing in the morning, just to recite them again to yourself, you know, and setting that intention for the day to be, you know, following those precepts. And you know, even, you know, a little bit too complicated to go through 227, but, you know, we can reestablish the Buddha Dhamma Sangha as our guiding light for the day. And so you can just, you know, just start off the day with just setting that intention, like we're going to be, you know, on the, say, full practice. So just, you know, determine, yeah, I really want to take advantage of this opportunity to the best of my ability. You know, just even just starting with that thought for the day, you're going to start it off a lot better than hitting the snooze alarm, you know, 3 or 4 times. And then, again, it kind of depends on, you know, how much time you have when you do get up. But I know a lot of people do chanting in very near Ajahn Pasano's cabin. And oftentimes when I go by there first thing in the morning, I hear him doing chanting. He's got a whole series of chants that he does and does every morning. So he can bring in chanting, or oftentimes I'll like to, it's the one time I do like to read, so to get my mind kind of activated. So I'll have just even a page or something. You can even start off with like the new book we just published of the morning reflections. You know, just read one of the reflections very first thing in the morning, and so getting the mind activated and thinking in terms of Dhamma in a positive way. And then oftentimes a lot of people do yoga or stretching. So, you know, just bringing awareness, you know, fully into the body. Yeah, and just, you know, preparing the body as well as the mind for the morning sitting. So you can see how you can just, you know, use that, you know, that's even that initial 15, 20 minutes in your cabin or in your room at home or, you know, wherever you are. You can use it really skillfully just to set the mind in a beautiful way. And you know, at that point, you know, 20 minutes, you actually haven't even meditated yet. So it's like, but you've already, you haven't formally meditated. You haven't even mentioned, you know, sitting and, you know, watching the breath, watching the body. And so you've already, you know, established yourself in learning how to cultivate the mind and be paying attention, clear awareness. So like another one I've been paying attention to is the period right after the meal, because there can be a real tendency to, you know, all the energy of the body goes usually into digestion. And so that can be a real time of just wanting to go to sleep. And there can be a time for that, and that can be skillful. One of the pieces of advice that I really like that I got when I was in Thailand was to, especially if you have like all afternoons, like when we switch to more of an open schedule, you know, make a strong determination to, you know, as soon as you get back to your cabin or after the meal, to do walking meditation until you get to the point where you're not tired. Just really make a determination to do that. And it'll vary, especially by how much you've eaten and kind of the weather and other factors, but just make that determination just to do walking meditation however long it takes until you've overcome that drowsiness. And then if you want to at that point, then you can go lay down after the sort of the digestive part of the body is kind of finished draining you of energy. But really make a strong determination then to only say lay down for 20 minutes. I've heard people say that it's like if you go over that, then it's actually, you know, kind of counterproductive. Or, you know, when you do get up after longer than that, you might, you know, feel even worse than if you hadn't, you know, maybe more tired. So just, yeah, for 20 minutes and then get up and then continue to practice either sitting or walking meditation. So for the beginning part of the retreat here, just to kind of get out of the habit of you know, doing that, laying down, cautiously been going up to the workshop to do a little bit of kind of work up there. And Yeah, found it to, really good practice in the sense that, having an injury, I have to be extremely careful with, how I walk and how I move. So to be up in the workshop, I'm seeing how it's a really beautiful meditation, because I can see, like, if I have an idea for, like, say, a bookshelf or something like that, then I want to kind of make, there's the plan for how to make that. And oftentimes we can go through our lives like having the plan, and then actually thinking we're being mindful as we're building the project, or doing the cooking in the kitchen, or doing the office work, or whatever it is that the retreat crew people are doing now, filling propane tanks, or you can get the idea and the plan in your head. And then through the execution of that, it's really easy to forget, like, what the body's doing, or how we're interacting in the space. And it's almost like the goal is what's the most important thing, and we can be focused on the goal and kind of think that that's meditation. And in some ways it is, and we are aware enough of the body. But I've noticed this week that with this injury, that I have to be really, really careful. And so when I'm up in the workshop, I notice, like, there's this sense of when I'm walking around, I have to be, 100% aware of my body and how it's moving through space, and the posture in particular, and not kind of having my knee at a weird angle. So there's, 100% attention onto the body. But then I'm also working with power tools. And those that live here know my relationship with power tools. And so I have to be 100% aware of, the dangers involved in each of the tools and how to use them. And then also, then paying attention that you're actually doing the project itself, correctly, and you understand the direction. So there's all these different aspects that you have to be aware of. And so this is where I kind of started thinking about kind of compartmentalizing even the entire retreat, but just even in, say, like, that work project, it's like I see that I have to, it's really causing me to slow down. So, like, this injury is a real blessing in the fact that it's like, so, like, you just take the project, like, I'm standing at the work desk with the plan, and then to the, the first thing I have to do is to get the wood. So then I have to be very mindful to go over, walk outside to the where the wood's being stored. So very consciously, you have to start, the thought, okay, be very conscious of the moving of your body through space and getting over to that pile. Then this is where it gets difficult, because then you're trying to find, the right piece of wood, but you have to be moving, and you're using discernment to figure out what's the right piece of wood, and you're not sure where it's located, so there's doubt, but there's movement. So that can be a real test to being aware of all those different activities you have to do all at the same time. And then once you do find the piece of wood and you go back, then again there's a period of just carrying the piece of wood, but it's walking meditation. You're really thinking of it as of that. It's a awareness of the body, awareness of the posture, awareness how you're moving through space. Like, I've noticed just going from where the wood is stored to being on the perfectly flat level area of the workshop, just that little paved area in front of the workshop, just walking from the bay over to the door, there's at least three different angles of the pavement goes in, and just being very conscious of how when you put your foot down at all these different angles, it affects the pressure in the body in completely different ways, and potential areas where you could twist something that shouldn't be twisting. And so there's this real awareness of movement. And then then when you get to the starting to work with the power tools, it's interesting, because then you, at least when I'm doing it, it's like have to start off with there's going to be various different processes that have to happen, and so breaking them down into before you put the piece of wood through the power equipment that you're going to use. It's like, first, it's, again, coming right back to the body, being aware of the posture and and making sure you're standing correctly in a safe position too with the tool. But just being aware of the posture. Then when you start the tool up, then the next awareness is really when that tool is on of safety, you know, and how you are interacting, how you're moving with that tool. And then, you know, awareness of the project itself. Are you, is this really the right cut that you want to do? And so you can see that just, you know, in something like that, like, you know, just going up to the workshop and just cutting making a few cuts on a piece of wood, that you can really break it down into, areas of mindfulness. And it's interesting that, I think one thing that we don't talk about a whole lot in terms of meditation is, we do talk about sitting meditation a lot, or, you know, we practice that a lot. And especially on retreats, we do a lot of walking meditation, and I know a lot of people do walking meditation at their huts during all of the year. And we don't talk a whole lot about standing meditation or lying down meditation. And I was fortunate when I first started meditating that a few of my teachers did emphasize that. Stephen Rosemary Wiseman in Thailand, they would always do at the, in their retreat, they did an hour of standing meditation every day. And it was interesting that it was a concrete floor. Kind of meditation hall was about the size of this room. And the man standing next to me in the very first, probably 15 minutes of the very first day of doing this, fell asleep while he was standing and fell over backwards and cracked his head pretty good. And they said they'd never actually seen that, because the standing meditation is usually very good for bringing awareness to the body and, you know, bringing energy into the body. Can be actually a very painful meditation, especially when you do it for an hour. You know, after even like 10, 15 minutes, it can get quite painful. But they would have us do it for an hour. And so I was just looking up in the library there. Ajahn Suchito, in his book on meditation, has a nice introduction, or kind of just gives a little bit of, gives actually quite detailed instructions on how to do standing meditation and also lying down meditation. I don't think I've ever heard a Dhamma talk on lying down meditation. Well, that's not 100% true. But especially with, say, like the walking meditation and the standing meditation, you can start to see that, you know, like formally practicing those, and you know, what you learn about how to hold the body, how to release tension in the body, in the mind, you know, how to breathe properly in these various postures. You'll start to see that, like during the work period, during the work scene, you know, you're doing those activities all the time. You know, walking around the workshop, or standing in front of a power tool, or walking around the kitchen, standing in front of the sink. What you can learn during the formal meditation can transfer quite easily into the work scene, into the activities that we have to do to live in a community. So I think during this retreat, I encourage people to experiment with standing meditation. Either here in the hall or at your kuti or on the walking meditation path. It's like, as Ajahn Yanadhamma was saying, that if you're doing walking meditation and the mind just starts getting quite quiet, actually what might be happening is like you might be starting to get kind of irritated, and it's because actually the mind is quieting down and really does want more silence, but we maybe are resisting that by pushing ourselves into doing walking meditation because we think that's what we should be doing. So paying attention and maybe just even experimenting. Like sometimes if you do feel kind of quiet but there's an irritation, you know, maybe it's the body's actually asking or the mind's asking you to slow down. So you can try, during the afternoon periods of just doing standing meditation outside. Mm-hmm. I really like it when my mind does that. It just stops. I think it'd be nice if it gave me a little more of a transition from the what I was saying to the end of the talk. But I think, for this evening, I really just wanted to kind of talk about the structure, talk about how to use the retreat in a skillful way. And I think a lot of what I've been talking about is just in every posture, every activity that we do is an opportunity to learn about the mind, learn about our feelings, our perceptions, what we are habitually being conscious of, looking at our attitudes of pleasure, pain, how we react to those. And just trying to see this as a time of joy. This is using the structure to not only be able to support ourselves, but to support everybody else in the community. I think that's been mentioned a couple times, that just all of us showing up to the pujas is actually making it easier for everybody else, because we can see that. We have the energy to enthusiasm to practice, and it's easier to do it when other people are plugging in joyfully as well. One thing I was thinking at the beginning of the retreat too is kind of using the retreat time. It can get stressful in a sense that, like, because we're not communicating, we're not talking, and oftentimes there can be a sort of sense of uncertainty. And we're not, one whole way that we always interact with each other is kind of taken away without the lack of communication. So we can sometimes start reading into people's facial expressions or the way they're moving. And I'm starting to discover, like, one way to kind of counteract that, especially if we start telling negative stories, is to very consciously just appreciating each other, just to... the fact that that everybody wants to be here to be meditating, to be practicing, and that really helps. Like, when everybody is here for morning puja or evening puja, and you just really take joy in that. Or a lot of people have mentioned that we've had a lot of joy in the fact that the retreat crew, that you're really taking advantage of the group practice. And when you're not working, you're here for the readings, or you're sitting in the hall in the afternoon. Not all of the retreat crews in the past have done that. So that brings us a lot of joy to see that your enthusiasm. I used to do a meditation when I was on staff at IMS. Of every evening, I would just go through every single community member, and at the time I was using it in a way of thinking about every interaction I had with that person throughout the day. And then doing a sort of asking forgiveness in my mind of each individual in the community. But this way you could do the same thing, like just for a part of a meditation, or just as you're going through the day, every time you kind of, for a short period of time, I would do it all day long, but maybe just once, just sort of going through, and just every time you see somebody, just remember something that you appreciate about that person, or something good about that person, and that can really uplift the mind. So I'll leave this for our reflection. See me. Sadhu Karam Tavam Sayam.